Good morning, Your Grace and Eminences, Archbishops, and as we say in the House of Lords where I come from, Right Reverend and Noble Prelates, and many friends here and distinguished acquaintances. Thank you very much for asking me. May I begin by thanking two Archbishops sitting here beside me for organizing this fantastically timely and relevant conference to discuss a crucially important issue, and for asking a government minister, being discriminating enough to ask a government minister to join these deliberations. Politicians are always a bit worried, as you know, that they're not in touch. They go around wondering who is in touch, and it always seems not to be them. But this morning I learnt on the radio that phone hacking is a theological issue. So I feel I'm very much in the right place today. In particular, one of my tasks is to answer for all Foreign Office, all foreign affairs issues, all global issues in the Upper House, in Parliament, which I do nearly every day. And I noticed that today on the order paper I have questions to answer on Jerusalem, appropriately, on Papua New Guinea and West Papua and Indonesia, and on the southern Sudan. So you can see the sort of day, my normal working day, and it just fascinates me that it happens once again that I'm speaking on the very central subject of your conference, one of the places concerned, namely Jerusalem. Now, of course, the treatment of Christians worldwide and the freedom of individuals to worship or practice their own religion or belief without discrimination or persecution is an absolutely vital issue, and one which is of increasing concern to not only governments but all peoples, given the problems faced by religious minorities in recent months, indeed I have to say in recent years, across the whole Middle East region, on which the public and media around the world are very much focused at the moment, notably very unsettling stories and very ugly developments in Egypt, Iraq, Iran, and much wider afield in Indonesia, Pakistan, and Nigeria. I fear scarcely a day goes by without reports of attacks on faiths and minorities and attacks on Christian establishments and audiences and congregations, which is a grim reminder of the world we now live in. The Middle East is, of course, the birthplace of Christianity, and the Christian community has faced challenges there down the centuries. There's nothing new about that, particularly in the Holy Land. And they have felt vulnerable, or at least disadvantaged, and have emigrated in disproportionate numbers. I'm advised that in 1946, the Christian community was 22% of the population in British-mandated territory of Palestine, and it's now less than 2% of today's society, in, if you add up Israel and the occupied Palestine territories together. So this emigration has caused a loss of religious and cultural diversity in the Holy Land and has wider, profound, short and long-term implications for the future stability of the region, not least in terms of prospects for future negotiation of an agreement on the status of Jerusalem, which is obviously a central issue in the whole pattern of the Middle East peace process. It's clear that although Christians in the region have been a minority, they've played a major role in every facet of life in their communities for the past 2,000 years. We see this contribution everywhere across the occupied Palestinian territories, from schools to hospitals such as St. Luke's Hospital in Nablus, that serves the whole of the Palestine community, regardless of faith, and in the Ali Arab Hospital in Gaza, which is providing desperately needed health care to thousands of Gazans in the face of the grave humanitarian situation there. Although even there, there are sparks of hope and light as some business and normal activity begins to recover. In Israel itself, the monasteries and pilgrim houses ministering to the thousands of Christians who visit the Holy Land are an eloquent and constant reminder of Christianity's deep roots. The spirit of the people working in these places, with their love for others, embodies Christianity's message of self-sacrifice and service. And we should remember that compared to elsewhere in the region, the Christian community in Israel does at least have extensive rights to practice their religious beliefs. But of course there are problems. Although Palestinian Christians are concentrated in Bethlehem, Ramallah, and Jerusalem, travel between these places remains very difficult due to the restrictions on freedom of movement. And this is especially true between West Bank and East Jerusalem itself. The permit system for Palestinians to enter East Jerusalem for education, for medical treatment, and for religious worship is lengthy and complicated. And there are heartbreaking stories we hear all the time of sons and daughters unable to obtain permits in time to visit parents dying in hospital or attend the funerals of relatives. Those Palestinians who do have regular permits can spend hours every morning queuing patiently at the checkpoints. We, the British government, have lobbied the Israelis hard on the issue of movement and access, and we will continue to do so. Last year there were some improvements in the West Bank, but we believe there is still a considerable way to go. A Jerusalem resident permit for Palestinians is another area of concern. There are currently around 200 Christian families forced to live apart because they cannot obtain permits to stay together and because of the shrinking pool of Christians in East Jerusalem. Christians sometimes end up marrying West Bankers and have to move to the West Bank because they cannot get the permits to live together in East Jerusalem, which of course reduces the number of Christians even further. If a Jerusalem resident moves to the West Bank, within 2 years, they risk losing their Jerusalem ID unless they can prove that Jerusalem is the center of their life. My colleague in the Foreign Office, Alistair Burt, who's the Under Secretary of State, concerned particularly with the regional area, visited Israel and the occupied territories earlier this month, and he raised the difficulties faced by Christians, in particular the impact of residency restrictions in Jerusalem. These are very, very constricting things. And then as for the issue of Gaza, since the takeover by Hamas in 2007, the small Christian community, along with many secular Palestinians, have found themselves increasingly vulnerable to Islamic extremism and intolerance. Religious laws are rarely formally announced and enforced, but the pressure to wear the veil and for men and women to be separated in public has grown all the time. The YMCA has been attacked. The Great Stone Cross in one of the Commonwealth War Cemeteries there has been disfigured. Most of the problems Christians suffered in Israel and the occupied territories do stem from the mutual mistrust that characterizes Israeli-Palestinian relations. And obviously we see negotiations towards a two-state solution, if we can get that moving, as the best way to resolve the conflict, meeting the national aspirations of Israelis and Palestinians, and leading, we continue to have high hopes, to a sovereign, viable, and contiguous Palestinian state, living in peace and security alongside a safe and secure Israel and a stable region. That remains the ambition for which we work. Your Grace, the United Kingdom government is concerned about the issues surrounding Christians in the Holy Land, very concerned, as I've just described, for three reasons. First, the future viability of the Christian community in the Holy Land is in question. Secondly, the decrease in the Christian population has an impact on the preservation of the Christian religious sites, which are of global importance. And third, the decrease of the Christian community sends the wrong signals about religious plurality and diversity in the Holy Land, as we remember, as we always do, of course, that Jerusalem is a holy city to Christians, Judaism, and Islam. So what do we, it's easy to analyze, the world is full of analysts and experts, but what do we do about all this? Our ambassador in Tel Aviv, Matthew Gould, his good friend, and Sir Vincent Fein, also I know very well, the Consul General in Jerusalem, take the issue immensely seriously and continue to lobby the appropriate authorities hard on the issue of movement and access. And the government places real importance on the right to freedom of religion for all. It's in our values in this country, and indeed in our struggle to emerge from our own dark past, where we had plenty of, in our history books, as we can read, plenty of bigotry and plenty of attacks on people for their religious faith. But today the government strongly supports the right to freedom of thought, conscience, religion or belief, and the right to freedom of opinion and expression as set out in the key international human rights instruments, namely the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, and the relevant 1981 United Nations Declaration on the elimination of all forms of intolerance and of discrimination based on religion or belief. As the Foreign Secretary, William Hague, has made clear on many occasions during the 15 months we've been in government, the effective promotion of human rights, including religious freedom, is central to our British foreign policy. Freedom of religion or belief is a priority human rights issue for the government, and William Hague has tasked officials to look at ways of strengthening our policy in this particular area. As part of this work, earlier this month, my Foreign Office colleague, Alistair Burt, I've already mentioned, hosted a Wilton Park conference on promoting religious freedoms around the world, Wilton Park being our sort of outsourced outreach conference centre down in Sussex, a very fine and effective place. The event was attended by religious leaders, non-governmental organisations, parliamentarians, and members of the Foreign Secretary's Advisory Group on Human Rights. That's the new group which William Hague set up. We will now be taking forward the insights and opinions of the attendees at that conference in our policy review. Your Grace, although some of what I've mentioned today and the personal accounts from yesterday that I know you've heard may sound disheartening in a troubled world, on a note of hope, the Arab Spring, as long as it doesn't turn into an Arab Autumn and maintains its momentum, does remind us that the mood of change is in the air, and that perhaps we can look forward to some brighter developments in the future. In Egypt, we saw Muslims and Christians standing shoulder to shoulder during protests calling for change with shared hopes for an inclusive participatory democracy. In the long term, it could be that the Arab Spring and the driving forces behind it may change things for all. Christians, Muslims, Jews, and all faiths in the region for the better. It may be. So I hope my words won't sound too negative and will assure you that everyone here, that the government, of which I am a proud member, is committed to protecting and defending the rights of all religious groups, including Christians around the world. We will continue proactively to promote and protect the freedoms of individuals to worship or practice their own religion or belief without discrimination and without persecution. We will continue to condemn all instances of violence and discrimination against individuals and groups because of their faith or belief, wherever they occur, and whatever the religion of the individual or group concerned. And we will continue to make the case that Jerusalem should be a holy city for all faiths. Perhaps that last point, Your Grace, is the most central of all. For 1,000 years, Jerusalem has been the seat of Jewish sovereignty. For Muslims, it was and is the city of the great Islamic prophets, Abraham, David, Solomon, and Jesus. For Christians, it is the holiest of cities, where Jesus preached, suffered, was buried, and rose again, the very center, so the medieval Christian world, of the whole entire earth. So, Your Grace, Jerusalem's an idea in which there should be room for all. If we cannot match that vision of a city upon a hill with room for all faiths within the reality of the Holy Land today, then we're letting down generations to come and betraying the faiths of generations past. So let us hope that we can succeed and overcome current challenges, and that Christians and others can live in peace and brotherhood in the land and the city which are holy for so large a part of mankind. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much indeed. I think that all here will have been helped and encouraged by the clarity of analysis that we have been offered in that address. And I think there are five adjectives which you used during the address which many of us would want to hang on to as extremely significant for all our discussions. The three adjectives about the hoped-for future of Palestine: sovereign, viable, contiguous. That is, a territory that makes sense and is sustainable in its own terms. But also, the two adjectives you used about the hopes of the Arab Spring: inclusive, participatory. Those hopes remind us that our discussion is framed in terms of human rights and human liberties very broadly, about the nature of citizenship, which came up yesterday, about what we hope not simply for Christians in the Holy Land, but for everyone in the Holy Land of all faiths, and indeed for humanity itself. And it's very good to have our discussions informed by the kind of presentation we've just had. And as I say, I hope others than myself will find some encouragement in the sense that that analysis is shared and pursued on the other side of the river here.